It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A controversy has arisen over the use of a test for graduating nursing school at Duquesne University. Is the test a true assessment of necessary skills? 20 years after Pennsylvania law allowed for charter schools, the debate continues over their state funding and the impact on traditional public schools. That's coming up, but first.
A turnaround shot that rattled wide. Subban, one more try, deflected over the net, and the Pittsburgh Penguins again are the Stanley Cup champions.
That's Doc Emrick on NBC calling the end of the game of Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals Sunday night. He said champions again, specifically back-to-back champs, and the fifth time in the Penguins' 50-year history. How important is that to the franchise, in the sports world, but more so to the community? We are pleased today to be joined by Bill Littlefield. He's the host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WESA Sunday mornings. He's based in Boston and at WBUR, but is in Pittsburgh this week. Bill, welcome to Pittsburgh. Welcome
Thank you to the very show. Much. It's great to be here.
Also with us in studio is Sean Gentile, sports writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Sean, welcome to you.
Hey, thank you.
The Stanley Cup, back in Pittsburgh. The parade is over. Gentlemen, first of all, the immediate impact of winning a Stanley Cup, or for that matter, any championship of the major sports. What is the immediate impact? Bill, let's start with you.
Well, I think one thing that happens is you don't have the negatives. You don't have anybody walking around saying we was robbed. It was fixed. When you win, it's all good. And people build a connection over time to various players. Sometimes it's an imaginary connection. You might not actually see these guys in the delicatessen or the grocery store, but you feel like you know them. You see them on TV all the time. You hear their interviews. And you see their faces, and you're happy when they win, when good things happen for them. So, you know, puts a smile on people's faces.
I don't think there's any better example of that than Marc-Andre Fleury, the Penguins goaltender. This city and the community of Penguins fans has a connection with him that is unlike, honestly, anything I've ever seen here. I mean, you had I was joking about it throughout the Penguins run, but it seemed like there were a group of fans who would rather lose a Stanley Cup with Marc-Andre Fleury than win one with Matt Murray, you know? Those people came out of the woodwork during the postseason run because of how long Fleury's been here and the kind of person that he is. So that was an undercurrent, I think, of the entire postseason run, and we're seeing it now because Marc-Andre Fleury's time in Pittsburgh, you know, by all valid accounts is finished. So we are seeing that bond that cities can form with athletes. I think he's a great example of it.
Bill, is it longevity or is it just the character of the individual? What is it?
I think it's both. The longevity is certainly a big part of it, especially in these days where players are a lot more likely to switch teams over the course of their career than they used to be. But it's also the character. You know, if somebody is associated with boys and girls clubs and hospital work and visiting kids when they're ill and comforting their families and doing all those things that athletes at their best do, that person is going to be highly regarded and you're going to really wish for good things for him or her.
And is that coupled with, well, somebody sort of took their job and they at least outwardly behaved like we would hope that any professional would do?
Yeah, of course. Exactly.
Yeah, going back to use Fleury as an example, I mean, publicly, privately, every teammate who's ever spoken about him has said that he's top of the charts in terms of guys that they've ever played with. So you have that public image in his case, it's certainly deserved where he's lauded, I think, by everyone he's ever played with. He's in UPMC commercials. People know his kids. People have seen his wife on television. And I think a big part of it in his case, and this is true of bonds that are formed with specific athletes in general, is he was the bridge. He was the first member of the current core to be a part of the team. He was drafted in 2003. The team's future in Pittsburgh was absolutely up for debate at the time. They were terrible, and he was the only bright spot on that team until Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin joined the team after the lockout in 2005. So I think people remember that, and I think it speaks to something larger about the bonds that are formed between cities and individual athletes overall, because people remember that he was around when times were tough. And I think that's an important thing to people here.
I want to explore that relationship, that bond, not just with the athletes, but with franchises. And what does that mean rather than just, oh, I sort of know them because I see them play. Pittsburgh, medium market, 6 Super Bowls, 5 Stanley Cups now, 5 World Series titles, although none since 79.
Right.
None since 79. Can any other medium market match that? What does that mean for a sports fan base, but in the broader sense to the community, Bill?
I've lived in Boston since 1972. For many years, the joke, and it was kind of a dark joke, in Boston was when a man would die, he would say to his son, "Not in my lifetime, son, but perhaps in yours." And what he'd be referring to was the Red Sox.
Yes.
People can't say that anymore, of course. Red Sox have won several World Series. They won their first in many years back in 2004. It changed everything. There was a whole culture in Boston built around, how are the Red Sox going to fail this year? And even when they had great teams, great pitching, great hitting, it didn't seem to matter. Something would go wrong. You know, a ball would go between somebody's legs, he who is not to be mentioned.
Yes.
And that's just not there anymore. That part of the cultural experience of being a sports fan in New England is gone.
So the fandom, as far as numbers at the ballpark, didn't change, but it was the attitude?
Yes, the attitude is utterly different. Young fans in Boston now do not understand what it used to mean to be a Red Sox fan. And there's no way they can simply read Curse of the Bambino and understand it. It's not available to them.
Yeah.
Because they know the Red Sox as a team that contends and wins World Series and a team to which good things happen. And that's not what the old Red Sox were.
I'm 31 years old. My freshman year of college was when the Sox broke the streak. And I have watched them over the last, 13, 14 years go from dreading the worst to expecting the best at all
right.
times. And that is certainly true of the Penguins. I was in high school. I grew up in Greenfield. I was in high school for the dark ages when it seemed like the team was going to move. And it was 3 years, but it was formative for a lot of people. But over the last... over the last 10 years, it's just been remarkable to see the expectations here rise to a level that's insane at times. It's not just enough to win hockey games. I think there's an expectation here of also doing it in a stylistic way that's where they're scoring goals and there's an added level of expectation here. So I think that's a natural byproduct of success, and it's there's no other way to put it. People get spoiled.
Bill, do you think there's a different perspective? You were using the Red Sox example when they finally won in 2004 after, what was it, 8 decades or somewhere around there?
Going on 9.
Oh, okay. Do you think there's a different perspective when it is a larger city? Of course, Boston much larger than Pittsburgh, does have more professional teams, or not?
I'm not sure there's much difference. I think that there is an attitude that develops around teams, no matter what city you're talking about. It's interesting that you bring up Boston and Pittsburgh in the same breath, because the Steelers and the Patriots have presented their fans with similar experiences.
Right.
There was that stretch of time when the Steelers were always, if not Super Bowl winners, then at least contenders, and the expectations for what the Steelers would do were very, very high. The Patriots are currently riding one of those streaks. And, of course, they don't go on forever. But right now, New England Patriots fans are among the most arrogant and obnoxious fans that you'd ever want to meet, because their expectations are so high. They regard Bill Belichick as a genius. Geez, he wasn't such a genius when he worked in Cleveland. But mysteriously, geniushood descended upon him when Tom Brady became his quarterback. I can't understand how it happened. But there's a sense of almost entitlement that success builds for fans. And I think probably Steelers fans felt it back when the Steelers were on top. And to some extent, you probably have a better answer for this than I, but Penguins fans may be feeling that way now.
There's a level of entitlement and arrogance. And I say that with all affection as someone who's spent most of my life. That's part of the fun.
Absolutely.
And also now part of the fun is and this is something that wasn't true 10 years ago, you can see how other fan bases interact with Penguins fans, whether it's on Twitter, whether any sort of social media. You get a sense and I know this is true of fans in Boston as well, whether it's Red Sox fans or whatever, you get a sense of how fan bases are regarded outside of their individual cities.
And that's an interesting point, because I think grace among fans can be measured by how they respond to what happens in another city. If you're a baseball fan and you weren't happy for fans in Chicago last fall, I don't know how to address you.
It's absolutely,
even if they're in our division?
I don't care. I don't care.
Honestly, Bill, I agree. But by that same token, as we've said about the Patriots, as we've said about the Penguins, we're like a year or two away, and we might already be there, of Cubs fans being completely insufferable. That's just the way that it goes. Like they're the Death Star. They're built to run the
season,
league.
In the next ten years, gone from being the perennial loser that people couldn't imagine. You know that the apocalypse would be upon us if the Cubs ever won the World Series, and now you're saying they're close to becoming the Death Star.
I'm telling you, it's going to happen. You know Theo Epstein as well as anybody. You know he's a smart guy, and he's got them positioned to be really, really good for a really long time. So we're on the verge of seeing another obnoxious juggernaut kind of created over there.
Of course, Theo, former GM at Boston, now GM with the Chicago Cubs. Individual perceptions of not just the sporting event itself, but the impact of that victory are interesting. We're going to hear now from a couple of Penguins fans. First, Mike Anderson. He grew up in South Williamsport, and he wasn't a Flyers fan. He now lives in Houston, and he made the trip up here.
So I came all the way up just to hang out with these fine folks. The adrenaline, the sport. There is no explanation. It's the Daytona 500, it's the Super Bowl, it's the World Series, all wrapped in one.
Pittsburghers are so crazy, and we're all about our sports, and it's just like a togetherness. It's great.
The second voice we heard was Kristen Durst from the Pittsburgh area. She says championships bring us all together. Do they bring more than sports fans together? Do they bring communities together?
I think in a temporary sort of a way. But for a time, sure. It's fun to watch the parade. It's fun to watch people throw the Stanley Cup into a swimming pool and all the other silly things that they do. And people laugh together at that sort of thing and celebrate and wear the hats and all the rest. So, you know, more power to them. It's fun and no harm done.
Sean, do you agree that it's temporary? But overall, does it help maybe somebody's self-image that they meet somebody from another city or they travel? And I'm from Pittsburgh, you know, with the Stanley Cup champion Penguins or the Super Bowl Steelers or whatever it happens to be.
One of the things that I've noticed is it's people from Pittsburgh constantly dress as if they're worried that people will look at them and not realize they're from Pittsburgh, whether it's Steeler jerseys or Penguins jerseys or 412 hats or whatever. There is, here more than a lot of places, there's absolutely a sense of identity and a sense of pride that comes from the success that the sports franchises have here. And whether that's a healthy behavior is very, very debatable. People here, it means a lot.
I think it's debatable, as you suggest. It's also variable. Mm-hmm. People can be enthusiastic about their teams in all sorts of positive ways, and the enthusiasm can also take negative turns, and we've all seen that. And it's a shame when it happens, but we should probably accentuate the positive.
So I want to put this question to both of you. Bill, as you observe sports from a national perspective, and Sean, as you cover maybe local teams and, you know, visit other cities, do you get any sense, do you get any vibe about how they view Pittsburgh, and do they view it through sports success?
I think it's probably hard to generalize on that sort of thing. I know when specific athletes either do something extraordinary or glorious in one way or another, there's a national sense that, hey, whoa, that guy's better than I ever thought he was, whatever it might be. Likewise, when an athlete in Pittsburgh or anywhere else is entangled with a criminal act or something that he does that brings shame upon himself and his team, that's something that everybody notices now, because we live in a universe where it's very hard for anybody with any kind of celebrity to get away with anything because there's always somebody there with a cell phone ready to take their picture and put it up on social media. So it's all more public. And the reactions that you're talking about are all amplified by the time in which we live. Beyond that, I think it's probably a little tough to generalize.
Yeah, it's important to remember that the image of yourself that you put out towards everybody else, towards the public, that's how people are going to perceive you. It's because people from Pittsburgh are so enthralled and so enveloped kind of in athletic culture here that when they do that, that's sort of how everybody elsewhere perceives them, for sure. They're linked, and there's no way to unlink them at this point.
They often say that food can bring people together.
They're right.
So does sports bring people together, or if you're in opposite cities, can they take you apart?
I think sports, at their best, they bring people together, and it's not limited to a city. I mean, for example, we haven't talked at all about the recently completed NBA Finals. There's a certain number of people who watch LeBron James and say, my gosh, he's the greatest basketball player I've ever seen. And they root for him because they want to see him do something ever more spectacular because the doing lifts our understanding of what human beings are capable of. We see people fly and we say, my gosh, it changes the way I understand the limits of what it means to be alive on the planet. And that's pretty exciting. The other way in which people are brought together is in their dislike of something. I hear from people all over the country all the time about the Patriots are crooked. It's a penalty every time you get within 12 inches of Tom Brady, whether you hit him or not, all of this stuff. So people are brought together by their absolute certainty that they're being cheated, you know, by the NFL. And the Patriots are the beneficiary.
I'd like cheating. To say for the record that I don't feel that way at all.
No, I know, because you're an insider. I mean, right. You see what actually happens. But if you're just sitting at home watching the action on your television and you see the same team winning over and over again, it's very easy to get angry at that team and to say they're winning at the expense of my team. And so people are brought together by that sort of emotion as well.
Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs Sunday mornings on WESA. Of course, Bill is based in Boston. And Sean Gentile is a sports writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, is a standardized test a good measuring tool for graduation from nursing school? It's caused a controversy locally. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Penguins officials estimate 650,000 people showed up for this year's Stanley Cup Victory Parade, and that's a big jump from the crowd of 400,000 that showed up last year. Officials think Wednesday's nice weather contributed to the surge. And a new report looking at housing finds an average Pennsylvanian making minimum wage would have to work 83 hours a week to afford a one-bedroom rental. And advocates say there just isn't enough affordable housing in the state. Find more of this week's top news at WESA.fm.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Graduation, a time of joy, pride, relief. 156 Duquesne University nursing students completed 4 years of training with passing marks, all ready to begin a medical career. But 24 of those students weren't allowed to graduate last month. University says they failed a standardized test needed to finish their degrees. That has led to some confusion, some anger. We're going to talk about this and the idea of using standardized tests as a requirement for graduation with Ben Schmidt, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, who's done a series of reports on the topic. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us, and please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. It's called the Health Education Systems Incorporated, HESI test. Ben, this isn't required for the accreditor by the accreditors or by the board that awards the licenses, correct?
That's correct. It's been used at Duquesne and other nursing schools as kind of a preparatory exam.
And they use it differently?
Different nursing schools use it in different ways. At Duquesne, you have to get a certain score on the test to graduate and then go on and take your boards to become a nurse.
Okay. And other schools just use it, what, for practice, for just another learning experience? What?
There's some of that at some nursing schools, and there's also some that use it maybe as a final exam. So it's a portion of your final grade, maybe 20% or something like that. But at Duquesne, and there's other schools doing this as well, other nursing schools, you have to get a certain score to even graduate.
Do we have a number of sort of what that would be? You know, because we think about letter grades, A, B, C, et cetera.
Well, and that's where some of the dispute has arisen. Duquesne had a score of 925. That's since been lowered to 900, and I can get into that later. Right. Some other schools have different scores, 850. Some have it. Some have said that you should be able to pass your boards if you get an 800. So that's where some of the students have complained that, hey, this number is arbitrary and it's not fair, and we're suffering because we could not graduate.
Ben, Duquesne University has told you, has told WESA, that it uses the test as a precursor for graduation to, quote, ensure patient safety, end quote.
Yeah, correct. And their side of it is that you need to know this material and you need to know it well, and then you need to be able to go and take your board exam and know it well. And if you don't know this material well, how can you be a nurse? And that's what some of the, you know, the people who are on the side of Duquesne in this dispute, that's how they feel.
So do they feel it just sort of complements those 4 years of learning or what?
Correct. It's just another necessary exam before you take your board exam. And their argument is, what's wrong with that? You should know this material.
Okay. So you've talked to administrators?
Correct. Yes.
And students. So who did you talk to at Duquesne?
Well, I talked to the provost first. I've talked to a lot of people in their media relations department. There's been letters that were given to me from the dean of the nursing school, the president, Ken Gormley. And then I've talked to students, parents, and actually a bunch of the students who were felt wronged by this. They banded together and they hired a PR firm in Pittsburgh, Ward Wright Communications. And that's really where the story came from. They were the ones who said, hey, we're representing a bunch of these students and they're upset about this. And we're going to be their voice, because some of them were actually afraid to put their name to it.
So what the students are telling you?
There's different, and I did also talk to somebody who failed it last year, and she had a very bad experience. She had to, she was still able to walk with graduates, but she did not actually graduate. So she had to come back after that and study up, and then she did eventually pass it and went on to start her career. So what she was saying and what some of the students were saying through the PR firm was that this test, this score is arbitrary. It's not fair. Why is it lower at other schools? We had good grades, or some of them have had good grades. We should be able to continue on, and we're being held up here, and we have to stick around in the summer. Maybe we're going to lose our jobs that we have, and all for this test.
All right. We talked to Jennifer Bootlin. She's from the Commission on Collegiate Nursing Accreditation. She, like you mentioned, a lot of nursing programs are facing pressure to up their own NCLEX passage rate. That test is the mandatory one for licensure as a nurse. HESI is not mandatory for certification, as we said, but it's widely accepted as a pretty good gauge. Here's Bootlin.
The increased emphasis by the federal government on this issue has trickled to the accrediting bodies and therefore has trickled to the higher education institutions. And this is the effect. More people are spending time and energy preparing students for a test.
Does this all go back to what we've heard, not just at the nursing school level, but at the public school level, the elementary school level, the high school, teaching to the test?
I mean, there's a component of that, I think, that is being argued, definitely.
Okay. Now, Duquesne University said these students, the 24, knew about the test. They were told 3 years ago and had to sign off that they understood that there were also pretests along the way. So it was not a lack of awareness, nor even a chance. They also had a chance to basically practice for this test?
They did, and there were other HESI exams given. This last one is called the HESI exit exam. So that is correct. That's their point of view on this.
The university sent us a statement today saying the university is now offering these 24 students free room and board and tutoring while they prepare for two retests.
That's right. They've also told me that as well. And the flip side of that is, again, that some of these students are saying, well, my job is held up. I don't know if I'm going to be able to, take the next board whenever that is. And they're concerned about whether they're going to pass it on the next time.
In your stories, you spoke with Daryl Spurlock. Who is he? He's a professor at Widener University.
That's right. And in his perspective, he's studied this issue, is that there's been other news articles in other parts of the country. This isn't the first time that he's heard about this. There was a school in Massachusetts where they actually did away with requiring the HESI exam to graduate after similar protests.
I want to bring into the conversation now Raymond Ark. Raymond is the news editor for the Duquesne Duke, who was also reported on this story. Welcome, Raymond. Good to speak with you.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Raymond, what did the Duquesne administrators tell you as to the reasons behind using the test? Is it similar to what Ben has learned? And whom did you talk with?
Yeah, I think Ben summed it up really well. I talked to the provost, Timothy Austin. I also got an interview with Dean Glasgow of the nursing school, and they kind of said what Ben already covered, that they thought HESI has been proven at different schools to be a good preparation for the NCLEX, and that they thought that since the students have known about it for a while, that there shouldn't be any problem.
And when you broached this with, I assume you also talked with students on campus as well, mm-hmm. did you? And when you broached that to them saying, what, didn't you know about it? You were supposed to know about it as a requirement and you signed off on it. What was the reaction to that?
Yeah, I talked to two students who are going into their junior year at Duquesne. They're both nursing majors. Both of them did say that they've taken two HESI exams already. They did say, you know, that they're difficult, they're kind of scary, takes a lot of studying. The one student, she said it's fair. She thought the School of Nursing sets the benchmark for a reason, because that really helps them get prepared for the NCLEX and the real world that comes after that. The other student felt the same way. She said that she had done well on the two HESI she's taken, but she did say that seeing that there's the 24 students this year not be able to pass it, she said she was a little concerned about how she might do.
I got to ask you, do you think that they are sort of, this was a sort of a wake-up call to these undergrad students, what has happened with this group of graduating students, or students actually who didn't graduate late this spring, sort of, hold it, I better pay more attention to that test, or what?
Yeah, certainly. The one student I talked to, she definitely sounded like this probably is a bigger thing to pay attention to, and that both of them, looking back on the two tests they've taken, know that this has got to be something that you have to study a lot for.
Now, realizing that Duquesne has its summer break, there are some classes going on. Do you sense this is much of a stir on campus about this issue?
Not from what I've seen at all. Since there aren't a lot of students on Duquesne, I wouldn't really know for sure, but there hasn't been any comments on the article that I put up from students or on our Facebook at all about it, so it doesn't look like there's been too much of any kind of thing from the general student body.
Raymond Ark is news editor for the Duquesne Duke. Raymond, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, remaining in studio with us is Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Ben Schmidt. Ben, parents of the nursing students sent Duquesne University President Ken Gormley and the provost a letter saying, I'm going to read a little bit from it, quote, the decision to use the HESI as a means to ignore 4 years of academic achievement, imposing it on students after they enrolled in the nursing school, all in an effort to maximize first-time NCLEX pass rates as a means to better market the nursing school, is not keeping with the mission of the university, end quote. That's just a portion of that letter. So is it ignoring the 4 years of academic achievement? Getting that diploma is based on passing grades in those 4 years as well as the test. It's not just the test. They have to be doing well in their courses as well, right?
Yeah, and I think the students who passed it, and I wanted to mention that I also got a call from a mother of a student who did pass it on her first try. And she said, hey, my daughter did it. Where's the recognition for her? We've got all these people complaining, and she did it, and the majority of the students did pass it. So, that's a good point.
Okay. I'm going to hear again from Jennifer Bootlin. I'll remind you that she is from the Commission on Collegiate Nursing Accreditation.
There are plenty of institutions that could argue that they have high pass rates without requiring a HESI exam. And likewise, there are plenty of institutions that could argue that since they instituted a HESI exam option or requirement for their students, that it's helped increase their pass rates.
Now, she is talking about the pass rates for the official licensing. Again, that is that NCLEX, right? So what did you hear about whether it helps or not that the passing the HESI, part of Duquesne's requirement to graduate, has it helped in the licensing or not?
I did hear that they do seem to go hand in hand. But again, the argument is, why are you holding up our graduation on this one standardized test?
Duquesne as well argues that their assertion is that it's the one-and-done exam. That's all wrong because we've talked a little bit about students can use the collective opportunities, quote, to identify problems, remediate, and be successful. It's also worth noting that more Duquesne students are passing the NCLEX since the school instituted the HESI 3 years ago. That goes to what we were saying. So, Ben, so you said other institutions. What are they saying? About the whole situation again?
It's split down the middle from what I gathered. I mean, there's even a former consultant for the company that makes and distributes the HESI exam who says it should not be used as, you know, for something that the student needs to graduate. But then there are other people, UPMC Chief Nurse Executive Holly Lorenz, she told me that this HESI exam is great and they love getting Duquesne students, Duquesne nursing students, so... There's a little bit of back and forth on that.
Okay. So, again, Duquesne lowered their score, correct? I want to repeat that.
They did. So the requirement was a 925 score, and that held up 34 graduates. And they lowered it to a 900, and that allowed 10 more to graduate. And now there's 24 who are about to take the test again, the HESI exam.
And that 900 is still a little bit higher than some that I think you cited.
Yeah, there are some that some schools require an 850, and there's been arguments and studies that say maybe even lower than that would still help you do well on the NCLEX.
But is that still very subjective, that number, or not? I mean, how do we assess what number is the right number?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I'll be honest, I never heard of the HESI exam before 2 weeks ago. So, it's been interesting, all the different takes on this.
Ben, we have just about 30 seconds left. So what is next in this story? What will you be keeping an eye on for this story?
Well, the big date is June 23rd, and that's when these students take the HESI exam again. So that's obviously something I'll pay attention to.
Is it the same exam, or does it get switched up because they've already taken it?
I'm not sure if they actually give them the same exact standardized exam, but it's the same format.
All right. Very good. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben.
Sure. Great to be here.
20 years later, the dispute continues over the funding and the value of charter schools in Pennsylvania. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh Pirates pitcher Doc Ellis throws a no-hitter while high on LSD in 1970. The feat is described in an animated short in a documentary about Ellis's life.
One time I covered first base, and I caught the ball, and I tagged the base all in one motion. I said, "Oh, I just made a touchdown."
While the claim is often disputed, it remains a popular story in baseball culture. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 16th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Monday, a celebration will be held in Harrisburg to mark the 20th anniversary of the enactment of the law permitting charter schools in Pennsylvania. But not everyone will be celebrating. Critics of charters remain. We're going to discuss the intent and the reality of charter schools with Mary Niederberger, reporter for Public Source and a veteran education reporter. Welcome, Mary. Good to see you.
Hi. Thanks for having me here.
And also in studio is Sarah Schneider, WESA's education reporter, who just completed a week-long series looking at charters. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thank you.
Now, if you have a question or comment, you can tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Mary, Sarah, a little bit of history, if we would, about charters. The passage of legislation Was it close? Was it heated? What's your recollection as you look back? Was it?
Well, it was approved. I don't think it wasn't very close. I mean, there are definitely supporters and opponents to the law. It was passed 5 years after Minnesota approved the first charter school in the country. And really, I mean, with the intent that these would be schools that would offer a unique curriculum, innovative teaching approaches. And though that still exists, that's still what they're supposed to accomplish.
Right. And the other thing that was supposed to happen is they were supposed to share their innovations with the public schools. The whole intent of the charter law was to allow these schools to be creative and give them a little more flexibility in regulations and in funding and in different areas so that they could come up with innovative ways that would improve academic achievement and then share it with the traditional districts. But that has never happened here in Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. I don't want to say they were looked upon to be partners, but the sharing, that was the idea in 1997 when the law was enacted.
That's correct. But from the very beginning, the traditional public schools were opposed. In fact, some of them refused to pay the bills when they got their charter invoices. They said, well, we're just not going to pay them.
Hold on a second. So let's go back to the process. So when a charter school wanted to be established, they had to apply through the school district where they were physically located.
Correct. A brick and mortar charter school. Cybers apply to the state.
Right. Okay. So, and then they could get refused, and then it's up to the State Department of Education, right?
State Charter Appeals Board. Yes.
Okay. So, even after the state approved, you're telling me that they refused to pay the bill or send the money?
Oh, absolutely. In the very early years, yes, especially with the cybers. I mean, the traditional schools really, they didn't get this concept. And yes, they refused to pay bills. And the schools had to go to the Department of Ed and get it worked out.
We talked about innovations and sharing. Was there another intent? Was it meant to be an option, an alternative to save public schools? What?
I would say that's what's happening now. That's what charter schools say they're here for. They're another option. I think that might have come from because that intentional sharing never happened. Because, I mean, the tension really came from funding because they see it as siphoning, you know, resources from their students, the traditional public school does. So I think that's what created the tension that they're not working together. And so now they're just this choice model.
That's for certain. And I think there are a very small number of states where they actually fund charter schools from a separate pot of money. And so there are probably better relationships in those states, but it's not very many. The model is more like what we have here in Pennsylvania, where every school district pays a tuition amount for a student who goes to a charter school. And every district pays a different amount. So you could have 10 kids from 10 different districts sitting in a charter school class, and the charter school is getting different rates of tuition based on their home school district's costs.
And I want to get into that funding because that remains an issue, and we'll see how it's addressed. And I know charters do support the idea of a separate pot of money at the state level. Explain to me, would you consider it a boom in the number of charter schools that erupted over the last 20 years that came about? Any surprises in the growth of numbers, would you say, or the number of students and their parents taking part of this with this option?
You know, it seems like a boom when you're in Pittsburgh Public Schools, if you're in the Woodland Hills School District, if you're in McKeesport, Duquesne, Stowe Rocks, because those are the districts where a lot of the kids, big chunks of the kids, have chosen charters. But then when you get into the rest of Allegheny County, they're not affected at all. So in Western Pennsylvania, a boom, no. Philadelphia, it's different. But in Western Pennsylvania, I wouldn't say it's a boom. But I would say when the opportunities have been presented in some of the districts that are struggling, parents have certainly taken advantage of them.
Sarah, what about students? How many students are taking advantage locally? Do you have any comparison?
Well, in Pittsburgh, about 14% of Pittsburgh students attend a charter school. Now, that doesn't mean
that's city of Pittsburgh.
That doesn't mean just city of Pittsburgh. That the district authorizes 10 brick and mortar schools. They can also attend. There are 16 others in other districts where Pittsburgh students can attend those neighboring charter schools. And then there are 10 cyber charter schools. So, yeah, 14% of Pittsburgh students, but only 10 within the city, 10 schools.
But Philly is so much bigger.
Right.
Yeah, Mary.
Well, that's because Philly runs under different rules than the rest of the state. In Philadelphia, the school district can turn a traditional public school into a charter school. And they've done that as part of their school improvement plans over the years. So they'll take a troubled school and bring a charter operator in to operate it. For the rest of the state, if you wanted to turn a traditional public school into a charter school, you have to have approval by 50% of the faculty and 50% of the families that are there. That's only happened once statewide anywhere.
And not here.
Not here.
Okay. Sarah, among the people that you spoke with for the series I alluded to earlier on charters this week, Pittsburgh Public Schools Superintendent Anthony Hamlet, I believe he told you the district is improving its schools with the hope of drawing charter students back to neighborhood schools.
You know, when it comes to charter schools, we really have to dig into the operations of charter schools and see what happens, because oftentimes charter schools are not supposed to be screening out certain kids, but you can easily see that's being done based on the demographics that are in those schools.
All right. So a traditional perspective from a traditional public school, did he acknowledge any success by charters or what?
Yeah, I mean, he acknowledges that some of the charters are doing good things. He has toured City Charter High School, which has the largest population of a charter school in the city. And he said they're improving outcomes for students, but he's still very critical of the charter system. And so, you know, he's wrapping up a year, his first year as superintendent of the district, and he says that he's going to bring students back into the public district, to traditional public schools. He points to, you know, the community schools model that was just recently approved and will start in the fall. So he says there are a lot of different ways that they're improving the school system to bring those charter students back.
Mary. So, Mary, I want to ask you one argument, one criticism of the charters: are they're not held to the same standard as the traditional public school. True or false? Is that the case or not?
In some ways it's true. And in one very important way that it's true is charter school operators pick their own board. So they don't have a locally elected board and they don't raise taxes. So people don't come to school board meetings and watch what they're doing. So they generally operate out of sight. As opposed to a traditional public school board, if you go to one of those school board meetings, you will see parents there. You will see citizens there. I think that's one big way. They're also guaranteed revenue as opposed to having to come up with a tax rate.
Sarah?
Yeah. It's 75% of charter school employees have to be certified. And that's a common criticism of the system. Teachers. So yeah. Special education teachers still have to be certified. Counselors have to be certified. Principals have to be certified. But teachers, 25% don't have to be. And so that's a criticism that they're not held to the same standards. They don't have to report as many data sets to the state as traditional schools. So, yeah, some of the bills in the state legislature right now are addressing some of those issues.
Okay, so that's board, that certification of personnel. What about student achievement performance?
Well, that's what I was going to say. There are some ways that they are assessed the same way. They all get a school performance profile, just like the traditional public schools, that's based on test scores and achievement. They have to report their school safety and their truancy to the state. They all have to file an annual financial report with the state, which the public schools do as well. So there is some similar reporting. I think the things that are different, some of them were done to allow them more leniency. Right. Like the 25% non-certified was to allow them to bring professionals in the fields, was to allow them to do more innovative things.
So not necessarily, quote, unqualified. It's just people with different life experiences that could impart some knowledge?
Correct.
Right. And I think some of the criticisms I was hearing about that in particular is it's been 20 years now, we should be held to the same standards. But you could also make the argument that public education has been around a lot longer than 20 years. So maybe charter schools need some time for that flexibility.
Okay. I want to get back into the funding issue. Is this really at the heart of it? Does this really come down to you are taking our money? And part two of that question is, will there be a separate pot of money for charters? Mary, why don't you start with that one?
It's absolutely at the heart of it. It's if you removed the traditional public schools having to pay tuition, you would remove the animosity. The chance of a separate fund with the state budget deficit, I just don't know where the money would come from.
And wouldn't they just be sort of carving out? So if we have this lump sum for basic education that goes to public schools, wouldn't they just basically say, okay, we're going to carve out this total amount for, and so the appropriation might be just less coming to the school district?
Right. People who argue for a separate fund, a separate pool of funding, are saying we need to cut something else in education. So it wouldn't come from the basic education fund. It would be separate funding.
Okay. We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to get your thoughts about where charters are headed. What's the future? And I want to talk about that. But let's hear first from Vasilios Skoumas. He's the CEO of Manchester Academic Charter School on the north side. He's held that position for 19 years. The school was one of the first three to open in the city.
The one hope is that Pittsburgh Public is doing so many amazing things that there isn't a need for charter schools. You know, we've discussed the possibility of maybe someday Pittsburgh Public will come and say, hey, we want you to be one of our schools. You know, we want you to be this, and you're kind of doing unique things, and we could use you as a lab, that sort of thing.
All right, you two. Are you surprised by that comment that the head of a charter say, maybe we won't be around? Maybe it's just we're incorporated into the traditional public school system. Mary?
Well, I think that's what the goal was in the beginning. So if you truly believe in the charter movement, that's the direction you should be moving. The possibility of that happening, I don't think it'll happen anytime soon.
You're shaking your head.
Yeah, definitely not anytime soon. Okay, I think that's a long shot. But
all right. One thing I failed to mention was about teacher evaluations. Are they required in charters or not?
Yes, they are. Most of the charters only hire teachers under a one-year contract.
Yeah.
And they're evaluated, and then they decide if they get another year contract.
Yeah, I mean, the House Bill 97 that's out of committee right now, so one of the things that it wants to create is a teacher evaluation matrix that would put them in line with public schools, but they are evaluated regularly.
Okay, so in our remaining minute or so, here's the big question. So 20 years of charter schools, will charters be around in another 20? What might they look like? What possible changes could happen? I mean, there seems to be every year talk about reform. We'll let you tackle that first, Mary.
Every year there's talk about reform, and it never happens. Part of that is because of the opposing parties in the legislature. The proposals just can't get enough support. I don't think they're going to go away anytime soon, because the problems in Pittsburgh schools and in some of the suburban schools that exist are going to take a long time to repair or correct. And until those problems are corrected, I think people are going to take the option of choosing a charter school because they think it's a better way for their child to be educated.
Sarah?
Yeah. Parents say they want an option, and sometimes that means not sending their child to their neighborhood public school, but they can't afford tuition for a private school, so a charter is their option, their choice.
So 20 years, when you both come back into this studio, we might be debating the same issues?
I believe so. Likely. I mean, I believe Superintendent Hamlet wants to improve the schools, but I think it's going to take a while to make the improvements.
Mary Niederberger is a reporter for Public Source and a veteran education reporter. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. By the way, our week-long series on charters can be found at WESA.fm. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistant Katie Zolkowski. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.